Welcome to Sports and a Slice of Life. And now, here's your host, Dave Lewis.
Aquila and Santa Clara, you are national champions!
Never, ever gonna get old. And I'm thrilled. And that will never get old. Winning a national championship is so, so hard. So anyone who's done it never gets old of that. Oh, for sure. And, I would say, if I'm honest about it, that I've probably had, about 15 teams that I thought could win a national championship. And this was one of them. And, and I'm not saying the others couldn't. I mean, who knows? You know, stranger things have happened. But we certainly had enough ingredients to know we were going to be good. Now, in order to actually win, things have to go your way. You got to come together at the right time. You got to avoid key injuries. You have to have other people step up when you do get injuries. And we had all those things and more. You know, the bigger question for us was, the things that were out of our control. COVID, will we come down with COVID? Will we have a positive test and have some close contacts that make us ineligible for the tournament? Will we get in enough games to qualify for the NCAA tournament? So there were so many more things out of our control this year than in any other year. But in terms of leadership and talent and depth, we had all those ingredients for sure. Well, I think there's always two sides to the coin. And, so anytime that you have to go through something that seems like a negative, there's almost always silver lining. And no one will ever know, for sure. I would rather have more than seven matches to prepare for the NCAA tournament. I don't think I've ever had a team, even our national championship team of 2001, that hit their stride after seven games. So I would not choose that. But did we avoid some injuries by having less games? Maybe. You don't know those things. And we chose as a group, we decided in the fall when our season got canceled, we chose as a group to find silver linings and find the positive in whatever thing came our way. And again, this year, there were just so many more things out of our control that, we chose that. And not everyone chooses that. And that's credit to our players. I think for young people especially, it's hard to find silver lining when you have a setback. It's hard to find the positive when you feel like there are things going against you. And boy, living in Santa Clara County with COVID felt like there was an awful lot of things going against us here. But we chose to look at the positive, and perhaps one of the positives were, we didn't suffer as many injuries during the regular season. Not really, Dave, if I'm honest. our athletic director, Dr. Renee Baumgartner, ran that by me in December. And, said, what would you like to do? And, I think I would have been fine, quite honestly, but, life for the student athletes was just really, really hard over this last 15 months. And I just felt living in a hotel, playing on a field that we don't know and don't know how good it will be, and having to play games away from campus, and it was just going to be too hard for us. And we talked about it, and I said to her that I would rather not have a season if we couldn't do it on campus and couldn't live in and around campus. And luckily, Santa Clara County gave us the green light. And luckily, Santa Clara University had all their ducks in a row and were ready for the green light. You know, we have so many people to thank for putting things together for us in a very short period of time in January. And we started practicing in February. But we never really wrestled with the idea to do it away from campus or in a different county. So we were always waiting for the green light. Thankfully, we got it. Yeah, we learned the hard way in the fall, quite honestly. You know, we came out of the gate flying like we normally do for fall season. And we just kept our fingers crossed and stayed optimistic that we were going to have a fall season. And slowly but surely, that got taken away from us. The NCAA canceled the championship for the fall, moved it to the spring. Our league, the West Coast Conference, decided not to have a league schedule, and they canceled the league schedule. And it was impossible with COVID to play any non-league games. So we tried to practice because we were already there when those decisions were made. Had we not been on campus, we would have never come in, but we were already there. We got there in mid-July, and those decisions weren't made until, I don't even remember, late August, I think. And we continued to practice, but it was really hard, and I didn't do a really good job of managing it. I've always prided myself on managing tricky situations or thinking outside the box or coming up with a good solution for tough problems, and I didn't. I was lost. I didn't handle it well. I had to show up one day to practice and apologize to the team for how badly I mismanaged practicing during COVID, you know, because we wanted to maintain our high standards, but maintaining your high standards with no in-person classes, no games, living in a women's soccer only bubble, and waking up every morning checking AQI because of all the smoky air. Can we practice? Can we practice for more than an hour? Can we have more than 50% intensity of practice? It was just brutal. And I pushed the team too hard. And I think we learned some very tough lessons. I learned some very tough lessons in the fall so that when we did get the green light in late January for February practice, we had a very different mindset. And I'm not going to say that we didn't try to uphold our standards. We did. We tried to uphold our standards. But we also took it very much day by day. And we're just really thankful for every day that we could get out there and practice. And so we had a very different attitude when we started up in February. You know, I try to just read the room, Dave, honestly. I didn't talk to any of the Santa Clara coaches, and I didn't talk to any of my friends in college coaching, women's soccer college coaching. I've always kind of tried to do it my own way and with just about everything I do. So, no, I didn't do that. But in the fall, I did a poor job of reading the room and realizing how difficult it was for our players. And so, you know, certainly our coaching staff talked about it a lot. And certainly I collaborated with our team leaders. We had four amazing team captains, Kelsey Turnbow, Alex Luetta, Julie Doyle, and Sophia Jones. And every year I lean heavily on the captains for collaboration. This year, more than most. And my problem in the fall was I wasn't collaborating with them as much as I should have been doing. And so through that collaboration, we were able to make good decisions for our group. Again, nobody else was living in Santa Clara County. I could talk to, you know, the Wake Forest coach or the Clemson coach, good friends of mine, but they don't have to deal with what we have to deal with. And so it was a very unique situation for us in Santa Clara County. I think I did have a couple conversations with Paul Ratcliffe at Stanford, not for advice, just because we're friends and we talk and, you know, we definitely shared ideas. It wasn't either one of us trying to solicit information from the other one. Just we're friends and we talk, and we both kind of commiserated about how tough it was to try to play sports in Santa Clara County. That's for sure. Yeah, we were devastated, you know, her. So we watched the selection show, whatever Monday morning that was. And we learned that we were one of the 16 seeded teams, and we knew we were going to the tournament because we're the automatic qualifier by winning our conference. And, but we were very pleased to learn that we were one of the 16 seeded teams. And in fact, we're the 11 seed. And after watching the show, we simply went out to the field to have what's traditionally a very light practice after we watch the selection show. And just while backpedaling with nobody around her, Sophia Jones ruptured her Achilles tendon. And it was devastating. It was devastating on so many different levels. Sophia is just this amazing young woman. And, you know, gosh darn, it just seems like those kind of things always, I don't know, it's just the one person that you just love the most and you don't want to have anything happen. She just gives so much to the team, and just the last person who deserved to have this kind of injury. No one deserves it, but you know what I mean. And so I just felt so bad for her. And I felt bad for our team, honestly, because she's a four-year starter. She's a senior. She's a captain. There's really only one place on a soccer field where it's critical. I'm going to use the word critical. That there's a great partnership, and that's the center back partnership. You know, the way that a lot of us play now, we throw so many people forward. The only two people back sometimes are two center backs, and they have to manage a lot. And they have to manage being a good attackers, good defenders, good leaders. And Sophia was our best voice on game day. And for people that don't know our sport really well, they think, well, you know, so it's always tough to lose a great leader in any sport. But in the sport of soccer, where we can't call timeouts, where there's only one stoppage in a 90-minute period to talk to the team, you got to have that voice on the field. That voice on the field is critical. And Sophia is our hardest worker, prepares the best, does the most film work. She's like a coach on the field. So losing Sophia was devastating for me on a personal level because I love the kid so much. But from our team standpoint, it was a really, really huge blow. Credit to Sophia. She had surgery. She recovered. She flew out with our team, and she was a great leader, even though she couldn't get on the field for us. And she led on the bus, during meals, in the hotel, from the sideline. So credit to Sophia. She continued to be a great leader for us, even though she couldn't play. And then credit to Eden White. Eden White, she hadn't started all year for us. Now, Eden is a junior player on our team, and so she's been training with us. And all of our players, Dave, train in two positions, their primary position and their secondary position. And one of Eden's two positions is center back. And so we started Eden there in the Ohio State game. Eden played every minute of all five playoff games for us and just did an amazing job. She couldn't fill the voice of Sophia, that leadership voice, but Eden's play was fantastic and a big part of why we were able to win. Yeah. So, first of all, Florida State was the number one seed, the best team in the country and undefeated. So we didn't see them changing to play us, but, they paid huge respect to our attacking players. And they changed what they had done in their previous 16 games to play us. So huge credit to our group for causing Florida State to change. We didn't see it coming. So the coaches didn't see it coming. So now we got to play 45 minutes. We can't call timeout. We can't make adjustments like you can in other sports. And so that first 45 minutes, you know, didn't go great for us. And we had to make adjustments at halftime. And normally these kind of adjustments are, we feel really good about our ability to make adjustments. We honestly couldn't figure out the best way for our team to play against Florida State. And the halftime talk that we gave to the team wasn't a very good one. And it didn't really solve tactical problems that we experienced in the first half. And, In fact, when the team left the locker room, they had a very kind of confused look on their face, like what are we doing? And then before they actually got on the field, we got in front of them again and tried to X and O the thing. And now they seem like they were even more confused. And we just didn't handle that really well. We just couldn't solve the game tactically. Now the good news for us is we don't rely heavily on formations, and we do rely heavily on what we call principles of play. So the attacking third, we do this. The middle third, we do this. The back third, we do that, both offensively and defensively. So we're asking our players to rely heavily on their training of principles of play. And, thankfully, that is part of our culture, and they were able to lean on that a little bit. Having said that, as a coach, you really want to be able to offer some assistance with some X's and O's. We just didn't do a very good job in that game. Now, the coaches and myself, that we take pride in that. We've had a lot of success in my 34 years because of the tactical adjustments that we do make. And that helped us get to the final. But I'd be lying if I say that our tactics made a big difference in winning the final game. It did not. The players really came through, and in the end, it was our leadership in the game, and it was kind of this mentality that the players grew into of, we're just not going down. We're just not going down. We were behind at BYU and came back and won. We were behind at Pepperdine and we came back and won. We're behind in the Florida State game, and I think the players we're going to come back, and we don't know how we're going to do it. We don't know when it's going to happen, but we're going to get our moment. And thankfully, when Florida State made a mistake at the back of their team, Kelsey Turnbow ended up with the ball, and she's just about as good as there is when it comes to finishing and finishing under pressure and finishing in big moments. And she did that for us, tied up the game, and allowed us to go to penalty kicks. Yeah. Oh boy, we were definitely on fumes. In addition to not getting the X's and O's right, I don't think I managed the our depth well enough. That's about as few bench minutes in a game as we'd played all year. In fact, it had to have been. I don't know that, but it had to have been the fewest bench minutes. And we have a pretty strong 16 players that we can play in a game, and we just weren't using our bench. So again, just, I don't feel good. If I could go back and do certain things over again, I would love to. We won, so I'm not too worried about it, but yeah, our team was on fumes. Florida State was dominating possession. The good news for us is they weren't getting that many dangerous chances. They only had two shots on goal the entire game. And if you'd have said to me before the game, you're going to play the number one team in the country and they're only going to get two shots on frame against you, I'd have taken in a heartbeat. And the good news about our team is our attacking players are lethal finishers, and they don't need a ton of chances. So as much as we want to create tons of chances and we want to score tons of goals, finals are rarely high-scoring affairs. They're usually 1-0, 0-0, 1-1. Sometimes it's 2-1. They're just not high-scoring affairs. And Florida State style guaranteed it wasn't going to be a high-scoring affair because they kept the ball at the back of their team a lot. And that it's frustrating, and it took a lot of patience and discipline on our end. But, you know, we had the chance at the end of the game. We were on fumes at that moment, and that goal lifted our spirits, put wind in our sails, got our fans engaged, re-engaged. We had great fan support at the game. We had great alumni support at the game. And it also just gave us that belief, like, here we go again. We're going to pull this game out. Again, we don't know how, but we know we can pull it out. And that belief was just huge for us. So we practice it a lot. We haven't had a great, my history is in coaching at Santa Clara, we've lost more games in penalty kicks than we've won. And we used to not really work on it very much. We practice penalty kicks almost every day when we go to the NCAA tournament nowadays. And the last time we were in a penalty kick competition prior to the final was 2018. 2018, we played North Carolina State and lost in penalty kicks. And I think especially since that loss in 2018, we've spent a lot of time during the year practicing penalty kicks, but certainly when we get to the NCAA tournament, and we have competitions within our team. So, you know, we play for, you know, silly things. You know, loser has to do this and winner gets to do this, silly things, but they bring out the competitive juices in our players. And, you know, it's kind of like going out and playing a game of horse with your kid in the driveway. You know, you don't, it's not really important, but it kind of is. You don't want to lose to your kid. And so the players are competitive. And I think that process really helped us because, boy, our players just look so calm and composed, and they weren't inside. You know, they're kind of turned, you know, their stomach is turning a little bit because they realize the magnitude of what they're doing. But, you know, we practice our breathing. We practice where our eyes need to be. We practice on the do's and don'ts of taking penalty kicks. And I think that was helpful for us. Yeah, we have to work on all of that because everybody has a favorite side, Dave, in terms of where they take their penalty kick. But the interesting thing is the goalie doesn't have to be in the middle of the goal. So what you run into sometimes is a goalie who's off center. And if that goalie is off center on the side that you want to go to, do you stay committed to that side or do you change to the other side? There's also a strategy which some penalty kickers use where they read the goalie's movement and make a last split second decision to go the other way. There are even some penalty kickers who look at the goalie the entire time and really don't even look at the ball. They use their peripheral to look at the ball and kick it to the other side of the goal if they can get the goalie leaning one way. So there's a little bit of scouting. Like we try to, you know, is the goalkeeper quick? Is she tall? Is she going to have trouble getting down to low balls? Like when we played Clemson and North Carolina, their goalie is very tall. So we practiced penalty kicks going on the ground only. The Florida State goalie wasn't tall. She's very quick. And so that allows you to shoot the ball higher into the goal. But the danger of shooting it higher in the goal is that you might hit it over the crossbar. And So the players have a lot to think about as they're stepping up to take their penalty kick. And I think in Florida State's case, their first two penalty kickers missed, and those two kickers had made all of their penalty kicks up to that moment. And I think for them, they worried about us scouting them. And so they had their kickers kick to the other side of the goal, meaning their non-favorite side of the goal. And in the end, you know, they missed the goal. And the cardinal sin in penalty kicks is you can't miss the goal. If the goalie saves it, the goalie saves it. Credit to the goalie. But you just cannot miss the goal. And Florida State's first two kickers missed the goal. And all four of ours nailed it. Well, in coaching, you're helpless, period. In soccer, you know, you're pretty helpless. Again, if we could call timeouts, it'd be different. But we have to rely so much on our players. But the beauty about it is, you know, you're really challenged as a coach to teach your players how to handle all these different moments. But the beauty of it is, you don't have to worry about controlling something anymore. You know, it's not like I can call a timeout with the field goal kicker and try to ice the field goal kicker on a last second field goal in a football game. There is no timeouts. I have no timeouts. I just have to, you know, observe what's going on and have faith in our players that they'll lean on their training and trust themselves to do the right thing. And our kids do that. So, you know, obviously it's a big moment and there's a lot of drama. But, you know, in 34 years of coaching soccer at Santa Clara University, we've had all the different moments, including winning the national championship and including losing the national championship. And how stressed I get on the sideline isn't going to change anything. So, you know, I'd say I was pretty calm about it, excited for the opportunity, but pretty calm. And I think you just learn that over the years that you just can't. The players are going to read. They're going to look at you and they're going to react to what you're doing. If you're overly excited, if you're overly nervous, my job as the coach is to remain calm in that moment, so they remain calm in that moment. And thankfully, that's what happened. You know, I think you're always evolving, but I'd say, you know, people have to coach to their personality. And my personality is pretty steady Eddie. It's pretty cerebral in what I'm trying to do. And I've always felt like if you're too emotional or you're too excited, it interferes with the intellectual part of what you have to do as a coach. You know, in fact, I've had many players, many teams say to me, "Coach, can you just get a little more fired up? It'll really help us if you get a little more fired up." And so I'd have to say I've kind of always been that way. Otherwise, I wouldn't have past teams and past players tell me, "Hey, you gotta get a little more fired up." And really, what they were looking for is there's tough moments. You know, your team is sluggish. You're not playing well, things aren't going, you know, you got to really inspire the team and fire up a little bit. So I've always kind of been pretty composed and almost composed to a fault. But I feel like that's also helped me be consistent in my coaching, and it's helped me last 34 years at Santa Clara. I honestly, to, you know, be so excited or so when you win and so down when you lose, it'd be hard to kind of get back on the horse and go after another season. Because Dave, to win a national championship, you have to put all of yourself into the effort, all of yourself. Every player, every coach, every staff member has to put all of themselves into the effort. And you know, the chances are not great that you're going to actually win the championship, but you have to be fully committed. And when you're fully committed and you lose, it's just painful. It's so painful. It hurts so much. And then to have to get up and do it, have the courage to go after it again, year after year after year is really, really hard. And that's why I'm so proud of my players. They know how difficult it is. And yet they absolutely put everything into the effort. And without that, we wouldn't have won. So in college soccer, we've done it so many different ways. The international way is two overtime periods of 15 minutes and then penalty kicks. In college soccer, we used to do two 15-minute periods and then two 15-minute sudden death periods. Then it went back to two 15-minute periods, and then it went to two 10-minute sudden death periods. And the reason it went to 10 minutes is
give me a count to five for me, Jerry.
With overtime. Yep. Into a two-hour time block for television.
You're there.
And so I said
in that text, I just Alex and, on some other time. Give her some love with her own conversation.
A two-hour time block.
She was unavailable this morning.
Season, you don't but go to I'd penalty love to, kicks. Love... It just stays as a tie. But in the NCAA tournament, there has to be a team advancing and a team not advancing, or a team winning the national championship or not. And so we have penalty kicks. In college soccer, we've tried everything. Four overtimes, two overtimes. We did unlimited overtimes. We did unlimited overtimes, and there was a men's game between UCLA and I believe American University that went nine overtimes. And then so when they went nine overtimes, I said, well, that's not a good way to do it. The game's going to last forever. Then after the nine overtimes, the NCAA decided that there would be four overtimes, and then it would be just declared co-champions. And I was actually on the men's staff, the Santa Clara men's staff in 1989, when we were co-champions with Bruce Arena's Virginia team. So we were co-champs in 89. And then so after each one of these, it leaves people dissatisfied. Co-champs is dissatisfying. Nine overtimes didn't make any sense. Penalty kicks is dissatisfying. There just doesn't seem to be a good way to end the soccer game. And so internationally, it's two overtimes and penalty kicks, and that's kind of where we're back to that again. Absolutely. And you could see it, you know, the camera was on our alums a lot during the final. And I mean, it's the who's who of women's soccer that we have of alums. But then you look at them, the passion, the intensity, the commitment, it was like they were playing. They were exhausted after the game. I mean, because they played, you know, and they do that because they care about our program. They're still connected to our program. We have a wonderful soccer family at Santa Clara University, and they make an effort to stay connected. We make an effort as a program to stay connected with our alums as well. And after the championship, you know, we took the team out. It was the first time that players could see their families. You know, we've been in a women's soccer bubble. So after the championship, there was no longer a need to be in a bubble. So we had to get together with friends and family and our alums. And there were a few speeches made that night. And Allie Wagner said something really interesting. It was really kind of, she put a perspective on it that I hadn't quite heard before. You know, she said, it's wonderful to be in the World Cup. It's wonderful to be in the Olympic Games, which she has done. And many women's soccer players from Santa Clara have done. But she said, the difference is that the national team chooses you, but you choose your college. So it was really a cool thing for her to say. And basically what she was saying is, I chose Santa Clara University. I'm committed to Santa Clara University. I'm committed to this program. This program is part of who I am. I chose this. And her passion and her kind of commitment was very clear when she was speaking. She got a little choked up, and I got a little choked up. It was pretty cool. But you could see that in their faces from the sideline. In fact, there was one moment, Allie actually lives here in my neighborhood with her four kids and her husband, Adam. And so a couple of my players are babysitters for Allie, including Kylie Halverson, who came in off the bench for us and played really well in the final. But at one moment after regulation, I was huddled up with our coaching staff on the field, and the fans are very close to where the bench is. And so I looked over, and sure enough, Allie Wagner had gotten as close to the bench as she could, and she's trying to coach Kylie Halverson during the game. Like, she's just trying to help us win. And of course, when I noticed that, I got Kylie away from her as fast as I can. Last thing I need is the players to be even more confused than they already were. But that's, Allie's just so committed. She's just trying to help us win. You know, it wasn't helpful, probably who knows what she was saying, but obviously they got to listen to just one voice. And even though I wasn't doing a great job on that day, still, that's the one voice they got to listen to. But that's the commitment. Yeah, you just can't have that, you know. And Allie knows that. Our players know it. But that, again, I think it's a sign of how invested she is. You know, first of all, when Brandy and my son Jaden flew out on the red eye on Sunday night, they got on the plane with about 40 or 50 other Broncos on the red eye. It was like a Bronco charter, and it wasn't, but it seemed like it. And, I'm not sure what the record is for alums coming out to support their team in college sports, but whatever it was, I think we probably crushed it. And again, the commitment, the intensity, just the closeness that we feel to our alums is pretty special. Yeah, there won't be any this year. In fact, it's going to be a challenging year because, you know, normally in a fall sport, you finish the championship in December, you decompress a little bit over the winter, and you kind of have this, you know, spring season where you kind of, you know, work out the kinks of the new team and slowly kind of, you know, ramp up a little bit, and then take a little bit of break in the early part of the summer, and then you get going again. And it really works out pretty well. Since our championship got moved to the spring, you finish in late May and the players will start coming back in mid-July. So it's really a couple of months. And it's really hard to do everything you need to. So it's gonna be very tricky for us because you need to shut down your body, your emotion, your mentality. You got to let that decompress, but then you have to get ramped back up again. And so it's gonna be a really tricky couple of months for us. And quite honestly, it's similar to what we went through last year. There was no playbook for what we went through last year. There's no playbook for how to do this right. And as I did last year, we're going to lean heavily on our collaboration with our team leaders, with our players, with our staff, and we'll just feel our way through it. And I know one thing, we won't come charging out of the gate. That'll be a mistake. So we're going to try to go. We're going to give as much time off as we can. We're going to try to start as slowly as we possibly can and try to ramp up and peak at the right time again next fall. So my way of recharging, Dave, is to be at home with my family. There's nothing I enjoy more than being at home with my family. That's the truth. I am a homebody. I love being in my backyard. I love gardening. I love, you know, playing, you know, card games with my son, Jade. And my older son, Cameron, lives around the corner from me with his bride and my two granddaughters. They come over every day as they did yesterday. I'll go over there. So my way of recharging is just being at home with my family. And, you know, but we've all learned to work from home. And so you just have to have a balance. There's no way I could shut it down. And quite honestly, I don't want to shut it down. I love what I do. You know, I love what I do. I enjoy what I do. And so it's enjoyable for me to work. It's enjoyable for me to coach. And since we can work from home, I've got the best of both worlds because I love my job and I love being at home. And so kind of the best of both worlds for me. But no, there's no downtime. Yeah, it's amazing. I'm so proud of Alex. The Honda Award is just about the most prestigious award that a young female collegiate student athlete can win. It's just such a prestigious award. To be the soccer representative in the Honda Award is incredible, and I'm very pleased. Alex is she plays in a position on the field that doesn't always get as much notoriety. You know, Kelsey Turnbow is Alex and Kelsey are amazing people and amazing players, but Kelsey is what she does on the field is it's obvious. I mean, she scores goals and she has points, and we do a good job of keeping stats in those areas. Alex's position, we don't keep as many stats. But Alex was probably the most responsible person for us winning in the final game. We weren't clicking offensively, but we had to be just really nails at the back of our team. Now, Kelsey's goal was massive for us, for sure, and we wouldn't have won without it. But Alex probably prevented 2, 3, 4 goals during the game with her play, with her leadership. So, and what a lot of people don't know is the position that Alex plays for us is not her best position. And so it's amazing that Alex can be so great and make such a difference, and she's not even playing the best position for her. It's where our team needed her to play. And when I asked Alex to start playing there a couple of years ago, she didn't hesitate. Alex just wants to win. And I love that about Alex. She just wants to win. She reminds me of Julie Ertz, Julie Johnston, when she played for us at Santa Clara. I did the same thing with Julie. Julie's a holding midfielder. Alex is a holding midfielder. Well, there were games I played Julie at center back to help us beat Stanford or some other top team. And I play Alex there so that we have a chance to beat the best teams in the country, which we did do. But it's really satisfying for someone who has playing in her second best position because that's best for the team to move to a position that's not going to get as many stats because of it. And then to get this ultimate reward by winning the Honda is just incredible. I mean, she joins a list of now only 4 people, Brandi Chastain, Allie Wagner, Leslie Osborne, and Alex Luetta. That is a really exclusive group. We've had a lot of great players that have played in World Cups and Olympic Games, but that group of 4 right there is incredibly special, and she's now in it. Luetta. Yeah, Luetta. Come on, that's Cal State Hayward. It always will be. No, we'll never cave into Cal State East Bay. You know, that's fine, but that's Cal State Hayward, and it'll always be Cal State Hayward to me. Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. I'm glad that we got it in. And yeah, I appreciate you, you know, covering our team for sure.
Distance for a shot, and she gets it in.
That is excellent, excellent football.
Tight angle, can't keep it out, and gives the Broncos a 1-0 lead.
Aquila, a mistake in the back, and Aquila makes the Tar Heels pay. The Broncos making their way to the NCAA championship game. Aquila, Santa Clara, you are national champion!